Welcome to the New York Skies Astronomy Seminar for 2021, April 2nd. And I am John Pasmino. The session today is the Omega Centauri Challenge. You need both files to enjoy this lesson. You're already listening to the audio file, and if you don't have the video file, please go to our web, www.nyskies.org. Among the jump words on the home page is audio video files. Click on it. The page you land on explains how the two files work together for the presentation. It also tells how to join our e-group, where you may comment or put questions about the lesson. Astronomers there, besides just me, can handle your questions. At the bottom, under the text, are links to the files of this and recent sessions. You're looking for the file beginning with 210402v.ppt. When you got that all fired up, you may resume the audio. I had two main inquiries since the last session. One, I referred to for the springtime stars a Selenohelion eclipse in January 2019. Several of you corrected me. It was the eclipse in January 2018 that occurred at sunrise. There was an eclipse in January 2019, a textbook total eclipse occurring in the midnight hours. And yes, I observed both, but crossed over the dates. The other inquiry is from someone at an astronomy club asking if they can use these lessons as presentations, sort of like playing a video or a recording from a radio show. The answer, of course, is yes. You do need someone to run a projector to play the PPT while the audio file is running. You also would need a time at least 2 hours for your meeting. The audio narration lasts something over an hour, so a 2 hour minimum is good for the length of your meeting. That should cover setup and takedown, announcements and news, maybe a break. All right, we're standing on slide one, which is a preamble or header. It summarizes the information in the AV files webpage. At the bottom is a link to a file, a reading file, an article, which is almost necessary rather than just supplemental. It gives all the ins and outs for observing Omega Centauri. If we advance to slide number two, the Omega Centauri Challenge is valid across a belt in the United States, or actually all around the world, between latitude 40 and maybe 42 degrees north, because Omega Centauri, one of the most favorite targets of observing in the southern sky, just barely clears the southern horizon when it is culminating in the south. If you live much farther south than 40 degrees, this target is an easy object and is no longer a challenge. It's higher in the sky, above horizon schmutz, above skyline, and in sight for a longer period of its diurnal arc. There's a supplementary target, a bit of a challenge, just north of Omega Centauri, called Centaurus A. It's abbreviated Cen A in the map. That is a galaxy, and we'll look at both of them during this session. So what is Omega Centauri, and what is Centaurus A? That's on slide 3. Alright, slide 3 is a stock picture of Omega Centauri. It is a globular cluster, not globular, globular. After all, it looks like a globe, not a glob. And it's simply one of a few hundred that we know in the sky. It happens to be the largest in size, and it's also the brightest, about 3 to 3.5 magnitude. If that were in high sky in the northern latitudes, like New York, it would be a trivial target, a favorite one for star viewings and public events. But because it skims the southern horizon, it could be pretty damn tough to see. Omega Centauri is so called because in the constellation Centaurus, of which we only see part of, it bears the Greek letter name Omega. Slide 4 looks at Centaurus A. Centaurus A is almost on the same meridian as Omega Centauri, but a couple of degrees farther north. It's also dimmer, about 7th magnitude, yet because it is in higher sky and above the severe obstructions of the horizon, it is easy to see compared to if it was on the horizon. I am guessing that around 44 to 45, maybe 46 degrees latitude, there's a Centaurus A challenge. I don't know of that. I only hear of the Omega Centauri. Okay, Centaurus A looks like a globular cluster with a scarf of dust around it. It is, however, around 10 million light years away, a whole other galaxy, and it's a much of an enigma. In fact, it's called the enigmatic galaxy. It is Centaurus A because in the 1940s, when radio astronomy got started, radio emission was pinpointed to this object, the first radio source in Centaurus, and radio source that's typically lettered, so this got the first letter A. Why do these two targets come so low in the sky and are visible for only a short arc of their diurnal path? We review in slide 4, you did switch to it, right? Okay. In slide 4, the celestial sphere. It's an artificial construct, but it's very handy for illustrating and understanding the motions of the heavens. It's a projection of the Earth out to infinite distances, as far as the stars are. Indeed, Ptolemaeus, in the 2nd century of our era, remarked that the stars are so far away that in comparison, the Earth in the middle is a point. We see an enlarged Earth in the lower left corner, and we see the axis of the Earth on which it rotates. That axis is coincident with the axis of the heavens. Around the 10:30 position on the drawing, we see NCP for Papa. That's the North Celestial Pole. And directly opposite, at around 4:30, is the South Celestial Pole, SCP. In this view, the heavens rotates from the far side up and around to the top, and then down in front to the bottom. The back part of the sphere is the east, and the front side is the west. The horizontal plane in the middle is the plane of our horizon, where we on Earth stand in the middle. There are three zones. Along the eastern horizon and then wrapping around to the top to the western horizon is a belt where the stars rise and set. That's illustrated by the red line with an arrow showing an object, I think it's the sun, doesn't matter, on its way towards setting. It would then run around under and to the back, to the eastern side at the rear of the globe, to begin a rise and a new daily rotation. Around the North Celestial Pole is a cap or lid containing stars where they have diurnal circles, but they're too small to intersect the horizon. These are circumpolar stars, and because they're always visible or open, they are semper patent. Around the South Pole is a similar cap of stars which are circumpolar down there, but whose daily arcs are too short to intersect the horizon and rise. They are semper latent. Now, when I was new in astronomy and learned these, which was obligatory in the old days of the 1950s, I kind of prided myself on the way to school on the bus. I was the only person on that bus who knew what circumpolar semper latent and circumpolar semper patent referred to. No one else did, not even the driver. All right, we move to slide 6. Slide 6 was a very standard and routine illustration in astronomy books and photography books. My father was into photography when I was a kid, and he read this article about getting this picture from your backyard. Well, I lived in a house with a backyard. Big difference from living in the backyard. We didn't even have the doghouse. Okay, so we set up the camera. We did it from indoors, from an upper floor. It was faced north and followed all the instructions. And then when we got the film back and looked at the picture, it looked exactly like a daytime snapshot of my yard on a very cloudy day. That was my first introduction to luminous graffiti. But if you're in a dark area, and perhaps with digital imagery, you don't have to run the film all night, just a couple of hours. That's probably how this picture was taken. And you see that the stars wheel around the pole. This is about 4 hours, it looks like, anyway. And the arcs are concentric about a point in the center, and the brightest short arc in the middle is a blessing for us in the northern hemispheres. That be the North Star. There is no such South Star for the folk who live down there. There are cockamamie ways to find out where the pole is. But we look at Polaris using any technique you learned in scouting, camping, hiding, maybe even the military. That's the North Star. So the arcs that go round and round are the circumpactant stars. And in the lower left and lower right, we see arcs that intersect the horizon. On the left, they are setting, and on the lower right, they are rising. But if you look at slide seven, we have a interesting situation. The Semperlatin stars are down in the weeds. You can't see them. So I had to do a simulation. This is from a planetarium program. The horizontal line in the middle is our horizon, is drawn from New York. By the way, for this session, whenever I say New York, I really should be saying the latitude of New York, which is 40.5 degrees. And you take out a map of your state or your country and run a ruler across that 40 degree to 42 degree belt, that's the marginal zone where Omega Centauri is a challenge to see. So don't think that you have to fly all the way to New York to see Omega Centauri. You don't. Okay. The circle, okay, up in the sky, I made this slide a month or so ago, so that's why you have the winter stars. The vertical blue band is the Milky Way, and I labeled some stars with their first three letters of their names. So you kind of have to know the constellation and stars to understand them. So the farthest left one is REG, that's Regulus, and then under the horizon is SPI, Spica. ALD is Aldebaran, and I guess now you can figure out the others. But that's the winter sky, and the Milky Way extends down under the horizon, loops around behind your head, over to the zenith, and back again. That's the great circle of the Milky Way. The circumpolar Semperlatin stars are within that circle. That's the same as the boundary of that cap we saw back on the earlier slide of the celestial sphere. If you have never been to the southern hemisphere or are otherwise unfamiliar with it, the abbreviated star names will be pretty you don't know them. SCP in the middle, marked with an X, is the South Celestial Pole. LMC and SMP are the Large Magellanic Clouds, and the SMC is the Small Magellanic Clouds. They are satellite galaxies of the Milky Way, discovered in the 1500s by explorers or traders down in the southern hemisphere. I think they went around Africa where they were first seen, and they were called Magellan, well, because he was the one who carefully described them and their position in the sky and called them permanent clouds. We sometimes call them Nubecula major for the larger one, and Nubecula minor for the smaller one. At about the 9 o'clock position, the way this diagram happened to be cut, we see OME with a plus sign that marks the location among the stars of Omega, and it is just outside of the Semper Latent circle. If you can imagine that the sky is rotating clockwise so that they rise out of the west and set in the right, the Semper Latent circle will also rotate, and Omega will just peep up over the southern horizon for about an hour or so, and then duck under, and for the rest of its diurnal arc, it is out of sight. So that constitutes the nature of the challenge. Slide 8 shows the United States, and if you can spot your state or more closely your city on it, and we have a latitude longitude grid also. If you follow about two-thirds or so on the right margin, we see 40N, that's the 40th degree parallel, and you can follow that latitude line as an arc across the United States where it cuts your state. That's the southern limit where Omega Centauri is a challenge object. South of there, you have, well, it may be a little difficult to see, but it would not be an actual chore or a task. It would not be a challenge. And the farther south, when you get down to 30 degrees, cutting through the south of the United States, Omega Centauri is an obvious object about 10 degrees up in the south, and is a favorite target for anyone in astronomy to look at. I hear from time to time that folk from Canada try for the challenge, and at first I figured, what the hell, they come down to the U.S., which they can do, you know, the borders are open. No, actually, if you look at Lake Huron and Lake Erie, you see that between the two, Canada, Ontario, comes right down to around 42, 41 and a half degrees. So I'm supposing that astronomers make a weekend of it, or even a star party in that vicinity, and try for Omega Centauri. I have not heard of any successful sightings, but I do hear from time to time that they try. Going to slide 9. Okay, slide 9 tells when the challenge is feasible. It's actually feasible any nighttime period when Omega Centauri culminates on your horizon, which is to say, when the sidereal time is equal to the right ascension of the cluster, which is 13 hours and 28 minutes, roughly. Okay, it's in the text. But when the two are the same, then the cluster is on your horizon, and also on the meridian. But as a practical matter, earlier than March, you're doing this in winter, at least in the United States, especially in the frostbite zone, it's winter. And that's not the time to take challenges in observing. You want to do observing in somewhat comfort. So, but also, the hour is in owl and pre-dawn. And however you may wish otherwise, 99.44% of all stargazing is done from sunset through midnight. And I know this for a fact. because when I go to star parties where you have the opportunity to stay up all night, you rented a bunkhouse, let's say, everyone is out there observing like crazy from sunset, and by the time 11 o'clock, you see people going back into their tents or into their bunkhouses, and by midnight, it's maybe 1 p.m., you have the whole observing field for yourself. Okay, so in April, the Omega Centauri culminates starting at midnight, and then progressively earlier, a half hour each week, all the way through May. Unfortunately for us, by the time you get into May, twilight has been pushed later and later on the clock. That is, the nights are shorter, and after mid-May, Omega culminates with twilight around it, and for all practical purposes, you're smothered. You can't try the challenge. So there's roughly 6, maybe 7 weeks in tolerably pleasant weather when you can do the challenge. And there's a little table down there. If you do like winter weather, just crank up your planetarium program and set the sidereal time to 13 hours and 28 minutes and look at the combination of dates and hours, and then bundle up really good, drink all the grog you possibly can, and go for it. If we move on a bit to slide 10. Alright. Now, if you're in an area where Omega is in high sky, like in this picture here, if the horizon is the lower edge, this is somewhere around 25 degrees north latitude, and obviously in a very dark viewing site. Good, look how nice the Milky Way looks. Centaurus is one of the ancient constellations. It's one of the 48 charter constellations, every one of which we did keep, plus 40 of the modern ones invented since then. But in the Mediterranean latitudes, only the north half of that constellation comes above the horizon. Of course, from the south side of the Mediterranean, Egypt, the Arabian Sea, the southern part of what's now Iraq, Sudan, northern Africa, you do get all of Centaurus. So they configured it as one of their original 48 constellations. If you're down there, you have all those bright stars, and there are several ways to home in on Omega. At first glance, Omega looks like another star. If you look at it carefully, it's a little fuzzy. Like when we look at the Orion Nebula, it's a star. And again, you have to know the southern stars, otherwise this gets to be pretty gibberish. The star Hadar, H-A-D-A-R, and extend the line northward through Epsen, and the same distance beyond that circled star is Omega. Now, Epsen is a finagle name. It did not have a historical name, as indeed a lot of bright stars in the southern hemisphere don't. So that's just a crashing together Epsilon and Centaurus, and we call it Epsen. It's unofficial. Well, all star names are unofficial, really, but it's a modern effort, so it makes it easier to refer to them. Ptolemy is also alpha star in Centaurus, and Hadar is the beta star. We see a couple of other Greek-lettered stars. To the right of Omega, we see Gamma, abbreviated G-A-M, and to the left, we see Zeta, Z-E-T. Above it is Iota, I-O-T. When the constellations were mapped in the 1600s, by a buyer, virus in Latin, and he lettered the stars with the Greek letters, and he just happened to get to Omega when he wanted to put a label on that globular cluster. To him it was a star. I don't even know if he mentioned it as being a misty or nebulous one, but it was bright enough and obvious enough to earn a Greek letter. Another way to find Omega Centauri is to draw a line between Gamma and Zeta, and halfway along that line and a bit north, the only obvious object is the cluster. That's in the southern hemisphere. If you go to slide 11, we got a different picture. Slide 11, we have a finder chart for New York, which is near the southern limit of the Challenge Belt. Omega is on the horizon. It's labeled here with its catalog number 5139. That's in the NGC catalog. Messier never saw this cluster, so it doesn't have a Messier number. Above it a couple of degrees is NGC 5128, or Centaurus A, or Enigmatic Galaxy. Now, when the NGC catalog was compiled around 1900, we had no idea what a galaxy was. In fact, the concept didn't exist. The Milky Way was the whole cosmos, and these were nebulae within it. Well, we knew that Omega was a globular cluster, and we just thought that Centaurus A, as we now know it, was a peculiar kind of nebula. It didn't get the Centaurus A name until after World War II, when it was detected as a powerful radio source, the first one in Centaurus. Note that there are very few obvious bright stars. In fact, you have to go all the way halfway up in the sky to Spica to find any considerable star that you can start from, like a jump-off star. Indeed, while you're out there waiting for the moment when the cluster is approaching the meridian, you watch Spica. When Spica is about to culminate, so is Omega Centauri. So that's a good marker to know whether you're out there way too early or by some god-awful fate, you got there too late. So you come down from Spica, which is off the top of the map. I have here altitude lines, 10 degrees, 20 degrees, and so on, which give you a scale. So Omega comes up in New York barely 2 degrees, and Centaurus A comes up around 5 degrees, maybe 4.5 degrees. What you have to do is star hop, say with a wide field eyepiece, from maybe the Gamma star in Hydra and or the Pi star in Hydra, and sort of drop down like you're playing ping ball and home in. Now, if you're very lucky, the star Zeta may peep up to the left of Omega. Or very, very luckily, if you're at the southern end of that belt of challenge, the star to the right, whose label is clipped, is Gamma. So if you can get both of those stars halfway between them and a bit above, if not, Zeta being a triple north, actually the same declination as Omega, then you hit that and you swim to the west. So if the challenge is not only because of its altitude and brief exposure time, but the fact that it's tough to home in on with surrounding stars. slide 12, please. All right, on slide 12, I illustrate that, of course, Omega is not the only globular cluster in existence. It is a beautiful sight. If you have a large scope and dark skies, the outer edges of it do break up into stars. Otherwise, it's a very condensed, round fuzzball, like a comet without a tail. But there are many, many, around 300 globular clusters that we know of. If you set your planetarium program, and hopefully it's one where you can turn on and off different kinds of deep sky objects. So if you do that, turn on just globular clusters and leave all the others off, and then cycle through the year month by month. And in most months, you'll find globular clusters sprinkled kind of all over the sky. But when you get to the months where Scorpius, indicated by ANT, that's Antares, and Sagittarius, no stars are labeled, between Sagittarius and Scorpius, there's a whole clump of globular clusters. Messier actually found many of them, the brighter ones. And he also found most of the other bright ones in the northern sky. We're going to have a quiz question for you after the lesson. Study this slide and your planetarium program and tell me why there are so many globular clusters in Sagittarius and Scorpius. We're going to have a quiz after the lesson, and we'll come back here to slide number 12. We will have a quiz for you after this lesson relating to this slide 12. In the meanwhile, we continue into slide 13. When assembling this lesson, I came onto several photographs of Centaurus taken from favorable latitudes, so the whole constellation was in view, and the authors sometimes drew the stick figures connecting the stars with lines. So I montaged three examples to show that the catch figures are not standardized. So you really cannot use a stick figure you saw in one book to surely identify a constellation. You either have to draw your own or adopt one from a particular author. When we spoke about star atlases, I brought out that the author of a star atlas will often put in stick figures, and that's a factor that you should consider when choosing a star atlas. After this lesson, we have a quiz question for you relating to this particular slide 12. Okay, so we move on to slide 13. This is a montage of several photographs of Centaurus. When I assembled this lesson, I found many of these, where the author joined the stars with various lines for catch figures. And these were all taken from latitudes where the entire constellation was in view. If you compare the pictures, and I use photos rather than charts or drawings, this way you can intercompare the stories between them. On a drawing, the author may just mark the stories he wants in the stick figures and leave out all the others. And with variation in scale and proportion, you probably can't compare them too well. You can see, though, that the stick figures are not standard. Each author makes up his own design, and therefore, knowing one doesn't necessarily mean that you will recognize the constellation. Star atlases often include stick figures on their plates. You have to consider the patterns in that atlas when making a choice of star atlas. Moving to slide 14, we see probably the most common reason for failure to see Omega Centauri. And this is a scene in an open field, like the one you might use for star viewing, and the horizon is low enough for all your normal routine star viewing. If you look closely in the south, you see trees, and the label for Omega Centauri is partly blocked by those trees. The dot above the label is the mark for the cluster. A few degrees above, we see Centaurus A, with a mark above that label for the galaxy. To do the challenge, you should really scout out your viewing site. Go in the morning, in the daytime, let's say so you can find a place. Look for a good place to set up at. Use GPS, a mariner's compass, the location of the sun, whatever, and suss out where the obstructions can be. It has happened where a person went to his favorite viewing site, was all ready for Omega Centauri, and at the hour when it should be near the meridian, it was behind a building he never noticed. There is another reason to reconnoiter your site. It can happen, and you probably won't know about it, in the next county to the south, there's a creepy doll factory. On the night you're looking for Omega, that factory is starting to run overtime during the night to satisfy the demand in the next holiday season. So its smokestacks, which may be, like I say, in the next county, you don't even know about them, sending out a smear of smoke along that horizon, which then blocks your view of Omega. On slide 15, we begin a series showing factors that could actually improve your chances of seeing Omega. In this slide, we have the Earth with its atmosphere outlined in white, and we're looking toward the sun. This is just the target in this particular diagram. It can be any celestial object. The straight line, the true direction, passes into the Earth before it reaches you, meaning that it is below your horizon. Your horizon is the horizontal plane through you, tangent to the Earth. But rays of sunlight coming from the right can pass into the atmosphere, which acts as a thin lens and arcs down that ray to you. When you see that ray, you project the line of sight upward, as in the upper line, to see the sun. The sun is in sight, although geometrically it already set. This is a grotesquely exaggerated view of refraction to emphasize the principle behind it. Yet, in reality, an object at the horizon suffers a lift up of quite half a degree. So you could be on a border zone where omega geometrically just barely rises, but refraction could pull it a half a degree up and you may see it. We can see this effect in slide 16, using the moon as an example. If this slide looks familiar, it's the one we used for first crescent back in March, because if this had been a first crescent moon, on higher sky it may be too bright twilight and you lose it. By the time it sets, twilight may be weak enough to show it, but geometrically the moon may set. Refraction lifts the moon. As we see, the diurnal path is bent upward with low altitude, so even though by geometry you lost first crescent for that night, refraction may pull up high enough that you catch it, so you declare the month one day earlier. If that were Omega Centauri that is below the horizon, because it just barely misses getting above it from your particular location, refraction could possibly get it above it. Okay, we have on slide 17 a skeleton table of refraction. It comes from the British Astronomical Association. It's just illustrating an article about refraction. It's not at all a full table. If you do any boating, sailing, navigating, you will have actually a book where you look up the altitude that you observe the site, and against it you will see the amount of refraction. Technically, that has to be adjusted by the local onboard the ship atmospheric pressure and temperature. For stargazing purposes, we generally neglect those corrections and go by a nominal table, like for 20°C and 1 atmosphere. So by 60 degrees of altitude, the refraction is approaching 1 arc minute. And if you're in coastal waters, especially those you're not familiar with, you're at night, you can't see landmarks, 1 minute of arc off is 1 nautical mile on the ground. 1 nautical mile is defined to be a minute of arc. And that could be disastrous in shallow or rocky waters. By the time you get down to low altitude, near zero, you see the refraction approaching and exceeding half a degree. In fact, the last entry for an altitude of minus 30 minutes, half a degree below the horizon, 33 minutes of refraction will pull that object into view above the horizon. Another factor in slide 18 is horizon dip, D for delta I, P for papa, or depression. If you're on the Earth's surface, your horizon is a plane that's tangent to the Earth at your location. If you are elevated above the horizon, above the ground, your lines of sight to the horizon, that is where the lines of sight then are tangent to the Earth, they form a cone depressed below the horizontal true horizon. The angle between your horizon apparent, well, actually, the true horizon down to the apparent horizon along one of those lines of sight is the amount of dip. an object can be below your true horizon, yet above those lines of sight, that is, between the cone and the horizontal plane. You can see that object. It is surprising, even for me when I first learned about it, how much that depression can be with modest altitudes. Now, in this view, I'm probably an orbiting satellite. That's me, Emmy. And the dip is, you know, tens of degrees. Well, when you get to that altitude, you don't really think of the horizon dip. You think more in terms of the area within the cone on the ground for transponded signals between the ground and the satellite. It's also why you put broadcasting antennas on tall buildings or on tall towers. First, to clear ground obstructions, particularly in an urban area with other buildings, but mainly because you want to get a greater broadcast reception area within that cone. In this case, the rays are signal emanating from me in all points inside that cone out to the horizon. Try slide 19. This is a very dramatic illustration of horizon dip. The author was on a cliff or a hill, 100 or more meters in height, I guess. The horizontal line which he drew in is the true horizon. Yet the author is seeing the sun. I forget whether it's rising or setting, but it's on the apparent horizon out at sea. And the amount of the dip is roughly the whole diameter of the sun. Now, maybe one of you can look this up. I did it once and I just forgot. From the 300 meter elevation of the Empire State Building terrace, the horizon dip is about 50 arc minutes. Even though I forgot that exact value, I do have many instances where I'm at street level on Manhattan and I see the sunset over the Hudson River. This has to be between at Manhattan Hens, of course. Yet all my lady buddies in high places, upper floors of their 40, 50, 60, whatever story towers, are still in sunlight. So consider horizon dip when scouting out an observing location. Around New York City, in New Jersey, instead of going to the Jersey Shore like the Barrier Islands, try viewing from the Jersey Highlands, where you can get a good view of the ocean at elevation. On Staten Island, the same trick can be done from the green belt of Staten Island rather than going down to the shore. In Brooklyn, Diker Heights and Fort Hamilton may be good instead of going to Shore Road. Moving on to slide 20, we have a table of horizon dip. Even for a couple of meters, like what you get on a small boat or a sailboat or even the top deck of a yacht, you get a considerable dip. When you take your sextant altitudes, you have to account for that dip. 30 meters near the end of the table, it's like an 8-story building, and you get like 10 arc minutes dip. So horizon dip can be a factor to apply when choosing your viewing site for Omega Centauri. Okay, move on to slide 21. There are only a few more left, so we're coming to the end of the lesson, and then I hit you with the quiz question. This is a deep picture within Omega Centauri taken with the Hubble Space Telescope. I know some people kid me. They say, oh, you went to Rockefeller Center, stuck your camera inside their Christmas tree, and now you're saying you took it of Omega Centauri. No, this is the real McCoy. Those stars there are 16,000 light years away. But the amazing thing discovered with this deep picture are the brilliant blue stars. Very brilliant, that is luminous, blue stars tend to be very massive stars, which in turn imply a short stellar lifetime, a few millions of years. It therefore seems that these stars were formed inside the globular cluster after the globular cluster was fully created and was living its life normally, hopefully, but stars were created during its life. This suggests that a globular cluster, or at least Omega, could be the core of a galaxy that came too close to the Milky Way and was stripped off of its spiral arms and most of its dust and gas, leaving a population of stars indicative of the original galaxy. In slide 22, we get a kind of a technical view. This shows the metallicity of a star, well, the globular cluster. In astronomy, the jargon is elements in a star other than hydrogen and helium are called metals. Sometimes they're also called heavies. Not that they, well, all the nuclei of elements are heavier than the nuclei of hydrogen and helium. And they're called metals because very often as a tracer of these elements, we do choose what would be a metal on the Earth's surface. In fact, these graphs here show ratio of iron atoms, or nuclei, to hydrogen. And the scale used is a logarithmic one, comparing the proportion of heavies in the star to that in the sun. A rating of 0 indicates the same proportion of metals in the star that the sun has. A negative number means lower proportion, and a higher proportion is a positive number. There are no positive numbers here. M12, the smaller histogram in the upper right, is a favorite globular cluster in summer sky. Its stars, almost all of them, have the same metallicity, much less than the sun, the logarithmic scale, indicating that the stars were created from one particular batch of original material and nothing new was added since. The larger histogram with Omega Centauri shows a range of metal content which aims at several cycles of star formation, or a continuing process of star formation, because the ones with more metal content came from material blown away or otherwise spit out, supernovated, from older stars with less content. That is, the star came into existence with an initial stock of heavies and then generated more heavies during its own lifetime. That also is an index that perhaps we are looking at a galaxy. It would be among the, if it is a galaxy, it would be about the very closest of external galaxies. Okay, let's move on to slide 23, which is the next to the last in our lesson. This is a combined effort of Hubble and European Southern Observatory over, I think it's 4 or 5 years. Every star in this picture is 16,000 light years away in the center, the core of Omega Centauri. Some stars in the middle have paths doped out from their proper motions, and those paths are orbital paths around some central mass which is not visible. From the size and speed of the orbits, that central mass is several tens of thousands of solar masses. Since we can't see it, and it doesn't radiate in any other wavelength, this is a very good candidate for a black hole. Again, the prospect that we are looking not at a garden variety globular cluster, but a whole other galaxy, or what remains of it. By extension, there is speculation that globular clusters, and we see them around other galaxies like Andromeda, M87, other closer ones, and they do seem to be captured small galaxies which have been distended, distorted, and stripped out of its outer materials, and only the stars in the core are close enough together that their mutual gravity can survive the disruptive tidal forces. Okay, and we're now moving on to the last slide, 24. Slide 24 is a telephoto digital picture of both Omega Centauri and Centaurus A. These are the views you would get visually in a rather large telescope. It might be the flagship or signature observatory or field telescope at a star party, the one where has the longest lines, where or the other telescopes, you get a couple of people, take a peek, and then they run over to the big guy. Okay, you can see that the outer edges of Omega are speckly, broken up into stars, and Centaurus A, you see that dark scarf around it. That dark scarf suggests two other common names. One is the Yo-Yo Galaxy, because of the two halves of a yo-yo, and then the string is tangled up between them. It's also called the Hamburger Galaxy, the two buns with the burger and fixings in between. But that's how close they are in reality in the sky. So when you look at Omega Centauri, be sure to nudge your telescope northward a couple degrees and pick up the enigmatic galaxy. So that concludes our lesson for today, and I now give you the quiz. If you go back to slide 12, and you see that knot of globular clusters in the Sagittarius-Scorpius area, why is that? I can give you a hint, but you really do got to dig out your textbooks and tickle the internet. It has to do with the construction of our Milky Way galaxy and our view of it from where we are inside. If you come up with a good answer or a reasonable guess, put it in our e-group, NYSKIES at groups.io. That is New York Skies at groups.io. You have to join it first, and that's what the AV5 webpage shows you how to do. Until then, April 16th is our next session. Pray for clear skies.